ghostly, mother. No ghostly.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
You know, recently on the show, we talked about Travis Scott and the Astroworld tragedy, and I mentioned that when you dig into the research there, you hear two names of other incidences, other historical events. One of those is The Who in Cincinnati. So I was wondering, does that loom large in your brain?
Yeah, when I was younger and a kid, the only thing I knew about The Who was that there was a Who concert, and it was in Cincinnati, and people got crushed.
Okay.
And so
like, before you knew the music, you knew this story?
I knew, yeah. And so it was like one of those doomy things where it's like, you know, do they sacrifice goats? Like, no, people just, they get smushed. So that was a creepy thing. So as I grew older and I would hear about those things happening at festivals where people would get smushed, like those things sounded awful.
And this is always the one that gets referenced, right?
Yeah.
This is like one of the first times that it's a big national thing. There's obviously other points in history where you have, you know, crowd problems and you have rock and roll tragedies, but this is a big one. And it looms large for a couple of reasons, which we're going to talk about, because it really changes the way concerts are done for several decades in certain parts of the country, and specifically in Cincinnati. Now, I was interested to know your relationship with this and other people's relationship with it and how much it looms large in their brains, because it looms large in mine for a couple of specific reasons, because I have a specific relationship with Cincinnati. Number one, something a lot of people may not know, place of my birth.
Yeah, and I forgot about that. That was the place of your birth.
That's where I was born. But now, I moved out of it before I was very old, so I don't have a ton of memories of living there or anything. But I almost moved there in 2016.
Well, I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, so I realized when I was doing this, I was like, I bet on Mike Murdoch's going to be like, dude, we were best friends during that time. So, why did I not know you were thinking about moving? I had a not good year in 2016. It was not good. I lost a job. Personal stuff happened. Yeah. Like lots of, it was just not a good year. I have good friends in Cincinnati, and one of them was working on getting me employed there. And we just thought maybe we'd just go start over and start fresh there. And I would hesitate to call it a depression, because I don't think I've ever, I mean, I want to be very respectful of that term and what that is for people. It's the closest I've ever gotten to being in a depression. And there was something appealing about just like blowing things up and then just moving to Cincy. But I didn't talk to a lot of people, including you, about it, because it was just, who knew? And then things really turned around at the end of the year, and everything has been great. And then, you know, a few years later, we started this thing. But because of that, I've also always had friends and family there. And so I've seen a lot of rock shows in that city, and it's a regional hub, sort of a sister city for us. Like we were just talking before we turned the mics on, like you're going to take a trip there this fall and spend a few days there. So like that happens a lot for people who live in the part of the country that we do. So I've always had a lot of fondness for it. And because of that, because I'm a rock and roll nerd, I've always known this. It feels like I've always known that there was this tragedy that happened in Cincinnati with The Who.
So I had a negative perception about Cincinnati, I think, because of this.
Oh, interesting.
And
well, this story does not make the city look cool.
No.
Nothing about it.
And I never imagined I would live where I live now, here in Louisville, Kentucky, in Cincinnati. There's
such proximity.
There's a river that separates the states. And I don't want to make sports references, but I hated the Bengals. Still hate the Bengals. Bungles.
We're going to talk about the Bengals a little bit.
Still hate them. And my only like connection to the Reds was Pete Rose and having an autographed baseball of his that says, I'm sorry, I bet on baseball.
So the Reds and the Bengals will come into the story shortly for a specific reason. Here's the most embarrassing part, though, about my relationship to this story. And that is that I used to think it was funny to reference this story at random.
Oh.
And it was very weird. I think it was because I felt this kinship to the region. But I would be like 12, and I'd be like in a crowded youth group meeting at church, and I'd be like, it's like a Who concert in Cincinnati in here. not my best moment. And there would be all these 12-year-olds who would have no idea what I was talking about. And then there'd be one youth sponsor who'd be like, what the hell's wrong with that kid? He, get him out of here.
Not
Why
cool.
is he being so uncool?
Not cool.
This is not a good look.
And I'm not trying to, whatever. Like, I just remember it being, I don't know what I read, Brian, but it was horrifying. And so whenever I read it being younger, it was something I never imagined. I never imagined the idea of
And you didn't want to revisit it.
No. And I think that maybe one of the first times that I went to a big concert, I think that was on my mind.
I mean, it would have been a defining thing, especially for you. For me, by the time I was going to shows, we were a good 15 years past this, right? But you would have been going, when was your first show, 86 or something?
The first one I went to was actually 79, but that was Kenny Rogers. So there was glow in the dark frisbees. That was the most dangerous shit happening at there. And so that was,
boom, you just get hit in the head.
And then 84 or 86. 86 is ZZ Top.
Okay, so ZZ Top, and this is jumping ahead, ZZ Top has to cancel a show in Cincinnati.
Yes.
Or maybe maybe they're the first show. Actually, no, I think they're maybe the first show back. After this tragedy, I think the first show that they allow back in the arena is ZZ Top. There's a couple that have to cancel. We'll get to all that. Here's something I didn't realize until doing this research, is that I have been to this venue. I didn't realize that this venue is still there because it's so old. Cincinnati concerts that I go to normally at a couple of places, we're just going to get regional for a second. You know what? People on the coast in New York and LA, they talk about their fucking neighborhoods all the time, so we're going to do it. I like to go to Bogart's and Cincy Shouts, Riverbend Amphitheater. Our friend Rosemarie has worked there forever and has hooked us up on more than one occasion to see some great shows there. Shouts to Rosemarie. We saw Blink-182 there together once. You remember that?
Yeah.
That was a good night.
Can I go dirty laundry on a dirty story for everybody?
Sure.
This is a Bogart story.
Oh, okay.
So, college?
Yeah.
I'm not going to remember her name, even though it'll take me a minute.
We'll call her Vanessa.
She was the college music director at WRAL in Lexington.
Oh, okay.
And I was the college music director at WUTK in Knoxville. And we had met some other
players. Right on.
But we wanted to go see the Afghan Whigs.
At Bogart's. Okay.
So we had, I can't believe it, we never talked about this. We had backstage passes and stuff and because of whatever.
Yeah. I mean, if there is one band that is ever going to honor college radio, it's going to be the Afghan Whigs. They owe their entire career to college radio.
So I think I remember her name now, but I'm not going to dump it in there.
Vanessa. I already said it.
All right. Thanks. Right. Vanessa. So something happened at the concert.
Between you and her? Between the band and the crowd?
Between her and one of the band members.
Oh.
And
should you be telling this story?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Proceed.
So I'm not going to say, I mean,
Vanessa. Vanessa. Yep.
I'm just not going to. I mean, it just was like unbelievably terrible.
Okay.
So instead of watching the show, which I did, she goes outside and takes a cinder block and throws it through the windshield of their van.
What? Not where I thought this story was going. Holy crap. All right. I love that. Okay. So
that was exciting.
That's our Bogart story.
Yeah.
Last time I went to Bogart's was last year, August of last year, about a year ago. Yeah. I saw Better Than Ezra there. It was good. You were not there because you fucking hate Better Than Ezra.
That's right. You know who's Better Than Ezra? Who cares?
So I did see a show once at what is now called Heritage Bank Center. It was called US Bank Arena when I went there. It was Muse. I saw Muse there with my wife
a long time ago. So I've never been to U.S. Bank Arena, Heritage Bank Center. I've never been to it.
Okay. A few years ago, there was this movement to renovate it because, as we will soon discover, it's not new. And it is kind of falling apart. And that deal to get it renovated fell apart.
The whole story of this arena and its current status is really interesting. It basically seems like the whole place is going to be abandoned as Visit Cincy, the tourism bureau there had turned its attention to a campaign to build an entirely new thing.
Yeah,
new
so they're in the middle of this. I was in the research, found this, and I didn't know this was going on. So they're trying to just build a brand new arena, like not even tear that thing down. I don't know what they're going to do with it once they build something new. But, and I don't want to get distracted, but I thought of another hilarious Cincinnati story.
Here it comes.
Which is that there's this site that has all the site, the places where they're considering putting this new arena. And one of them was labeled the former home of the Millennium Hotel. And I was like, oh, I didn't know they got rid of that. I'm very glad they did. Because in 2016, during this time where I was considering moving to Cincy, we went to stay in Cincy, and I called my buddy and I said, hey, we're going to get a hotel room, my wife and I. We're going to come up there and hang out with you. And where should we stay? And he was, and I was looking for rooftop pools. That was my whole thing. Was like, I just want to go somewhere with a rooftop pool. And there was one at the Millennium. So fancy. I said, should we go to the Millennium? Now there's Millenniums all over the place, but the Millennium in Cincinnati was built a long time ago and was falling into disrepair. And I did not know this, and he did not know this. So he says, sure, you should go to the Millennium. It wasn't super expensive, but it wasn't cheap. And lobby's really nice. And we go up to the room, and it's the shittiest hotel room I've ever been in. And I don't mean from like a like cleanliness standpoint, but it was like the bed was too big for the room. Like the room was tiny, and then the door wouldn't shut right. Like it was like, you know, like when you're in like a, when you're in like a storage space and the doors are like that weird consistency where they're like not very heavy, and you would like push it and it would like get caught on the carpet. It was wild. And my, and I remember feeling like you had to fall into the bed once you went into the room because there was like no room to navigate. There was just one big ass bed. Anyway, shouts to the Millennium, and thank God they killed that thing, and they imploded it like in 2019.
So back to this arena, US Bank Arena. The long and short of it, Cincinnati has lost several major contracts. One is with the NCAA, which is huge, and the other one is with the Republican National Convention. Those guys are geniuses. Over the last 10 years, because they've let this arena fall in disrepair.
Yeah, so they've actually, and when we say they've lost, it's not that they just like think like, oh, they were going to choose this, but they didn't. They literally have it in writing that these places are coming, and they end up going back on the contracts because they don't renovate to the level that they say they're going to renovate. Like they never got the renovations done. And so these entities have backed out of the whole thing. So that is why there is an active move to replace this thing. But this place and its history are essential to the story today. So we're going to go back to when it was cool and when it was new 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago, 1975. When it opens, it's called Riverfront Coliseum.
And this is because they put it next to a brand new stadium that they had opened 5 years before called Riverfront Stadium. And that's the home of the Reds and the Cincinnati Bungles.
I told you we were going to talk about them.
And we got there. Sports.
Yeah,
sports ball.
This was a really common move in the 70s. So I don't know if you know this, but there was this idea for cities, and this sounds, does not surprise me, that there were like city governments that were like, cool, if we built the a stadium the right way, we could have one stadium and two pro sports teams.
Yeah.
So we could have football and baseball in the same place. And so you get these cookie-cutter stadiums across the country that all felt and looked mostly the same. And at this point, most of them have been replaced besides this one. You've got them in Philly. You had them in St. Louis, Atlanta, Pittsburgh. They all do it around this time.
By comparison, though, the stadium and the Coliseum opened 5 years apart, and Riverfront Stadium was shut down in 2000. So this arena has outlasted its contemporary by 20 plus years.
20 plus years. Think about that for a second. So, yeah, that's wild.
Who's the first people? They have a tenant.
The first tenant inside Riverfront Coliseum is the Cincinnati Stingers.
Yeah.
Things don't go well from the very beginning for this venue.
Hockey.
Because this is a hockey team, and they were part of the World Hockey League expansion team. And if you're like, what the hell's the World Hockey League?
Yeah, right.
Well, it didn't survive the NHL merger. So that team within a couple of years doesn't exist anymore, even though they have this Coliseum to play in.
And they have a basketball tenant too, and the same thing happens there the same as the Kentucky Colonels who live here. They were in Louisville. They don't survive the ABA-NBA merger either.
So quickly, this place becomes used for college sports. But I will say, live music, always part of the plan, always part of the equation. The very first event to be held in this place is the inaugural kickoff celebration with the Allman Brothers and special guest Muddy Waters.
Good God. I mean, what a great bill, too.
That's unbelievable.
The fun fact, the second to last Elvis performance is in that venue.
Really?
Yep.
So he does, Cincinnati that night. I think he does Indianapolis the next night, and that's it.
Right.
I've lived in this area forever and never realized that this is where his live concertage ends. Do you remember we worked in a building? I've tried to verify this. The radio building we worked in, supposedly Elvis performed in that building at some point.
Right. And we'd hear that a lot. And remember... Remember there's the hallway, and the hallway had this big hump in it, and I used to be like, that's where he is, man. Little Lee is buried under this carpet.
Dude, I have forgot about the hump in the hallway until you started to describe it, and it was like a visceral thing. I was like, oh my God, the hump in the hallway.
Yeah,
that building is fucked up, and they still use it.
You're stepping on my belly, man. You're stepping on my belly.
Little Lee.
Good I always God. Just think of it's weird, like it's such a stupid reference. It's when I think it might have even been Rob Schneider, who at this point like really sucks, was Little E on Saturday Night Live, where they would just have him on top of, they would be driving somewhere and he was just on the dashboard.
True story. Rob Schneider had to step over that hump. We had him in that building.
That's right.
Remember? We had to walk him over that hump.
I gotta step over Little E.
You gotta step over Little E, buddy. Okay, so good God. This opens in September of 75.
And Elvis is June of 77.
Obviously, the most famous, infamous concert in this place, though, is not Elvis. I think the reason we don't talk about Elvis playing there is because of what happens a couple of years later. That's when The Who comes to town in December of 1979.
So let's throw The Who. What's The Who doing in 79? So we can kind of put that in perspective.
Great question. So we've talked about The Who quite a bit on this show before. Segments about stuttering and My Generation. That's on episode 53. There have been at least three episodes about Keith Moon, because you can't have a show called Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories and not talk about that guy a lot. Episode 17, 37, and 95. But all of those stories would have been previous to this period of The Who.
Right, and Keith Moon... who, by the way, someone sent me this has been around for years, and everyone's always, it's part of a Zeppelin lore. They did, I think, seven nights. They did seven nights at the LA Forum, and Keith Moon came on stage.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. So we've talked about
that. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You have sent me those videos, and I have watched them.
So he dies the year after that. So that's 78.
Right. Yeah. So did you know, I did not know this until I was just doing research this time, that Entwistle is giving an interview when he gets the phone call.
No, that he's dead.
Yeah.
He finds. No, I didn't know that.
Isn't that crazy?
What a drag.
And he like starts bawling and leaves the interview. It's wild. So Keith dies September 7th, and The Who's eighth record had come out on August 21st. So there you go. That's like 2 weeks.
Who Are You, right?
Yeah, that's Who Are You. 70, okay. And that's, this is the other thing. The core recorded output of The Who is only 10 records. It always seems to me like it should be more than that. I mean, you talk about the Stones, they have like, 50-something records. The Beatles have quite a few. You only have 10 from The Who. Now, they do two more in the 2000s, which I'm not counting for this. I'm just talking about the core stuff. So, if this is record 8, this is the beginning of the end, kind of, for them, and definitely the death of Keith Moon is part of that.
Right, and so, for Who Are You, famously, Keith is sitting down in that cover shot because he's gained a lot of weight in that at that time.
He is not in good shape. Obviously, you have a brand new record to promote and no drummer. This is not a good situation. And a lot of times, you know, you cancel the tour when this happens.
Yeah. So the story goes is that Townsend will persuade the rest of the band not to give up and cancel or quit the band together. He puts out a statement to the press the day after it happens and makes no bones about it and says, quote, "We are more determined than ever to carry on, and we want the spirit of the group to which Keith contributed so much to go on, although no human being can ever take his place," which is so interesting because 2 years later when Bonham dies, they're like, yeah, we're done.
Yeah.
Which probably for them was a writing on the wall, because think about where that band started, and by the eight, like they were kind of out of style, out of step, and they tried, but like they probably knew that their writing was on the wall, that band for sure.
Townsend will go on to say that this was a mistake and that this was him trying to handle his grief. But it's not even like they have a band meeting. He goes the next day to the press. I mean, they might have had a band meeting, but that's a very quick turnaround to suddenly go to the media the next day and be like, we ain't quitting. Nothing's going to stop us. So they do have to try to replace him. And do you know this story of who supposedly volunteers for this job?
No, but I'm going to guess it's Phil Collins.
It's yeah. So here's the quote.
I'm thinking about 85 where he's on the Concorde and he's playing in Philadelphia and London.
Yeah. It's great that you bring that up because this is 79. Phil Collins is not that famous yet.
No.
So in the next 6 years, things are going to fucking explode for that guy. But it's fascinating to think about this. We talk about the sliding doors moments all the time. Shouts to Gwyneth Paltrow. This is a great one. So here's the quote. I was working with Townsend just after Moon died in 78, and I said to him, have you got anybody to play the drums? Because I'd love to do it. I'll leave Genesis. What the hell? And Pete said, oh, fuck, we just asked Kenny Jones.
Yeah. So this is a crazy sliding doors moment in rock and roll because this is after Hackett has left Genesis, mm-hmm. and they have just released And Then There Was Three. So this is previous to any of their ever big radio hits at all.
Right. And they get Kenny Jones instead.
And Kenny's a familiar face and a friend of the band, and Moon knew him.
Yeah,
as well.
Moon was hanging out with him the night he died, famously. That's the story. That McCartney, do you know about the night Moon died?
They're watching the Buddy Holly, viewing the Buddy Holly story with
McCartney.
He was watching it with McCartney. Yeah.
And so supposedly both of them are there.
And Small Faces and The Who both come out of the mod scene in Britain. So this move is essentially grabbing someone from that scene.
Yeah, who's a
familiar person.
Now, I'd always been confused about the Small Faces versus the Faces. Do you know this distinguishment?
Yeah, they called themselves Small Faces because they were tiny.
They were short. They were little guys.
They were short. But when Steve Marriott left the band, he was replaced by two dudes from the Jeff Beck group.
You might have heard of these guys.
Yes, and by the way, for shits and giggles, go to YouTube and YouTube the Jeff Beck group. And you might find something and be like, did Led Zeppelin rip off everything from the Jeff Beck group? And let me tell you, it's fucking true.
Yeah, they did.
So they get replaced. So when Steve Marriott leaves the band, it's Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood. And they're not short dudes at all.
So they rebrand.
So they become Faces.
So the point of all this is just to say that 1979 is a year of mourning and transition for The Who. And with those things comes a lot of stress.
The music critic Bruce Elder has put it this way when explaining the post-Moon Who band. Quote, when Keith Moon died, The Who carried on, were far more competent and reliable musically, but that wasn't what sold rock records.
Now, that's a good quote, but, and they definitely probably were way more reliable. Hey, go back and listen to the episode about animal tranquilizers. But this only really speaks to their eventual wind down that's going to happen over the next few years because they were maybe as big as they had ever been in 79. I kind of forget this. I needed a refresher. There are two films that come out this year with The Who. The film adaptation of Quadrophenia. The existence of that film is going to play a part in this story, so hold on to that one. And The Kids Are All Right, which is a documentary retrospective about the band. At the end of the year, they will be the third band to ever be on the cover of Time magazine. I want to know if you can name the other two.
Is it not the Beatles and the Stones?
It's the Beatles and someone else.
Huh. Jimi Hendrix?
Nope.
Paul Anka.
What if it was Paul Anka? The Band.
Oh, that's interesting.
The Beatles and The Band and The Who, the first three bands to be on the cover of Time magazine. Interesting shit.
Yeah.
So The Who hadn't played the U.S. for 3 years. Their world tour hits the States in September. They have a horn section, so this is all very cool. And then there's a break. And right after Thanksgiving, they head back out on the road. They do somewhere, and then I think they do Detroit, and then they head to Cincinnati for the third show.
And really, I don't know if this is a spoiler, so, you know, kind of hang on. This is the most interesting part of the story. This incident will basically all center around how ticketing works procedure with that. And it'll change the way that fans go see concerts in Cincinnati in the area for decades.
The term that is used in the discourse when talking about this is festival seating, quote unquote. What that really means is unassigned seating, or what a lot of times you will hear referred to now as GA or general admission.
So even as a teenager, when I was going to see shows, I remember hearing that term, and I would think about that meant, so you can just walk in and be anywhere you want to be, and that's how you can get smushed. Like, that's really was in my head as a teenager, is sort of like a fear, you know? Okay, so 2 months later, this is February 7th of 80, an article by James Hinckley runs in the Rolling Stone, and it's called, quote, Cincinnati Curbs Festival Seating in Wake of Who Disaster. Here's the highlight of that article. 2 days after Christmas, the Cincinnati City Council passed two pieces of emergency legislation, both of which took effect immediately. One of them banned festival seating at any public gathering in the city except for religious events and high school athletic events.
What if you had to get ticketed to go to church? I'm in B1 for the Beatitudes sermon. Can't wait. Sorry, go ahead.
Do you want to go to the Lutheran church? StubHub has the best you can get.
We'll get you by the baptismal, motherfucker.
Oh my gosh. This is fucking hilarious. The other piece of legislation gave the police department more authority at such events, because why not? Quote, it was a compromise between giving police total authority and giving them no control at all, says Howard Wolkoff.
Amazing time capsule about all of this. Do you know who Howard Wolkoff is?
He's a government sensey person, but I don't know
what he is. Assistant to the city council person at the time, who comes out in the wake of this insisting that everybody should know that he's been trying to get rid of festival seating, like using it as a real grandstanding moment. And that city council person was a former mayor, and his name, Jerry Springer.
The rest.
The real Jerry Springer. Yeah. Like, it's not just a coincidence. Like, this is the, like, some people don't know this.
He was the
Jerry
mayor.
Springer was the mayor of Cincinnati before he had his talk show.
That's right. And you know what? Regardless if he was a douchey politician and had that douchey show, man, people really love Jerry Springer.
Well, and what's so fun about this is that this, what you're reading is coming from this 1980 Rolling Stone article that's archived. So, like, he's only a politician in Cincinnati in 1980. So you read this and it's just, that's, in 1980, there's just a guy. Like, that's not interesting at all. So it's funny to come across that stuff in the wild.
The rest of that Howard Wolkoff quote explains why the second part of the legislation matters, that second one. This is a quote, at the Who show, the officer in charge felt he had no authority. The law enables the police to make decisions like opening doors that would alleviate crowd conditions. But it doesn't give them the authority to cancel the show.
Right. Opening doors. This becomes a key part of this. So let's get into the play-by-play of what actually happened and how this would have not happened had there been reserved seating or more ability for people to open doors.
So key to all this is the idea that the floor of the arena was going to be general admission. So you just show up and first come, first serve. So a rabid Who fan who wants to be close to the action needs to get there early. Also, it's pre-internet, so the mass media is dictating information flow.
Yeah, so the radio's like, get there at 3 or whatever if you want to get in. Yeah. Show starts at like 7. So people start showing up early. And this situation is different from a lot of the crowd issues we've talked about because it all happens outside, not inside. So when we talk about crowds trying to get out of the fire at the Station nightclub, they're coming from the inside out.
This is
when we talk about Astro World, we're talking about people that are pinned to the stage. This isn't that. This is people trying to get into the venue.
Yeah. And if you didn't know that, like, super interesting, right? That this is like how this all went down. This is an interesting observation made in that Rolling Stone article concerning festival seating. So I wanted you to hear this too. They talked to this guy named Barry Bell, who books The Who, and he says Riverfront Coliseum festival seating provides exactly the same number of seats as reserved. Quote, but, added Bell, tickets sell better that way because when a kid is told the only thing available is in row 40, he just doesn't buy them. This way, at least he's got a chance, end quote.
And this resonates with me because my dream scenario for seeing anyone is a GA standing room crowd, preferably like 400 people, not 40,000. But I get it. I am more likely to pay if I know it's GA.
And now, at my age, I'm really excited when I understand that there's a seat.
I'm trying to not get to there. If it's a certain type of act, I might be more interested. Like, I mean, I saw Donald Fagen with a buddy of mine. I was cool. I was cool to sit down at that show.
I would have to sit down at that show.
Because you can't fall asleep standing up.
That's right. Yeah.
Knew the punchline on that one. Oh. Okay, so you have all these kids showing up because they think, in their minds, they're going to be really close to one of the biggest rock bands in the world. As we just said, this band that's about to be on Time Magazine. But the key component is everyone wants a fair shake to get up close. And so this depends on one thing happening, which is everybody having the same simultaneous access to get inside the venue.
So slowly, starting in the early to mid-afternoon, people start showing up and getting in line at all the entrances to the arena. And so what is expected is at some point when doors open, they'll all open at the same time, right?
But that's not what happens.
Right.
So instead, at one point, folks across the expanse of the outer arena look, and they were like, wait a second, I think they opened the doors over there, all the way on the far right side.
So this is from the Rolling Stone piece again. I want to read this to you. And this is more of the story of it. The doors were officially opened at 7:05, according to eyewitnesses. Four doors out of the 16 were open, and two of those were closed and blocked at times by guards with billy clubs, for Pete's sake. From where he was in the crowd, Phil Sheridan saw only one door open. I had a hold of my girlfriend, and my buddy grabbed me by the shoulders, and I took him by the hand, and we started to make our way through the turnstiles. Well, in that 10 or 15 seconds it took us to get our act together, we were now inside between the doors and the turnstiles, and the door was a frenzy. And they're still trying to take tickets. God, it was insane. I was three abreast in this goddamn turnstile, which was only 18 inches wide. People were getting hurled in and shoved through the turnstiles, and the ticket takers were still saying, where's your ticket? The initial rush came at about 6:30, because that's when people smelled blood, you know, the magic hour when they're finally going to open the doors for us. There was continuous pushing till 7:00. And then the doors opened shortly after that. God, this one girl, it must have been 20 minutes before the doors opened, and all of a sudden I feel a tug on my arm, and it's this girl, and her head was at my waist, and she said, excuse me, my feet are back there somewhere. And she was horizontal.
And so, damn it, this one group of people are getting advanced access, and so everyone starts pushing.
So they start knocking on the doors, banging on the glass, trying to get someone to open these other points of entry. Nothing happens. But inside the crowd, it's getting hard to breathe and hard to stay standing.
And remember, I said that Quadrophenia and that concert film, or that film, not concert film, have something to do with this story. It depends on who's telling this story. There are conflicting versions. But one of three things, happens around 7:15 while this crowd is getting pushed and perturbed. Either one, the Who does a late sound check, which seems unlikely. Two, management starts showing the movie Quadrophenia in place of the opening act. Or three, which seems maybe the most likely, a manager or someone is testing the audiovisual components inside, and they turn on a trailer for Quadrophenia. But regardless of which of those things it is, it doesn't matter. What matters is that loud noise that sounds like a band going on can be heard outside the venue now.
Right.
And so this makes everybody frantic, because now they think the band started early.
We're missing it.
And they're missing it.
Yeah. One thing we haven't even mentioned, we think we mentioned at the top, but we haven't really, really talked about it, is it's December 3rd in Cincinnati.
It's cold.
The reports that we have, it says that it was 36 degrees Fahrenheit, by the way. And all of that sound from inside is only the motivation most of this crowd needs to start heading towards those doors on the far right, and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, so they go from trying to go into whatever the other 12 doors they're near are, and they all start running towards the doors that they know are open. And this is so unique because it's outside the venue. So once you're inside, the experience of the drama is mostly over. Like, you're like, oh, we got through it, and now you're at a show. So there's this really chilling excerpt from that Rolling Stone reporting where a guy who they interviewed says that once he gets inside, he runs to find a cop. And this is why the cops and the cop response become a part of this whole thing.
Yeah. So here we go. Quote, He ran to the first policeman he saw and shouted, "What are you doing? People are getting trampled up there." The policeman looked him over and asked,
This fucking guy.
"What do you do for a living?" Klopp replied, almost in shock, "I'm working on a PhD in language." The policeman said, "Well, you just used a dangling participle." Klopp, caught up in the absurdity, said, "I think I know more about language than you do." The policeman smiled. "Well, don't tell me how to do my job then."
What a fucking dick. This is a quote from the Who's manager, Bill Kerbishley, about what the outside of the venue looked like when attendees went inside. Quote, "The band didn't see it, but I saw it when I went up to the plaza level with the medics, and I saw how catastrophic it was. There were so many people unconscious and on the floor and injured. I knew straight away that there'd be people dead. It looked like a bomb had exploded."
So in these situations, which are awful, there are two questions that have to be answered. One, do you cancel? And two, when do you actually tell the band, since the band doesn't know?
Right.
And
good
here,
point.
Here's where some of the Astroworld similarities emerge that we discussed, and that we're going to discuss there, is that Kerbishley convinces everybody in the production side of things to keep going and not stop the show. His reasoning is he doesn't want to start another riot.
Yeah, so the band will do a short encore, but that's it. Otherwise, things go on mostly as planned. But they aren't immediately told the extent of what's gone down. But when it comes to the encore, they're like, "Hey, just do a short one. We've got some crap going down." But they're not told details.
Years later, this is what Townsend says about his feelings about the aftermath of all of it. Quote, "I went through two phases. One was, of course, tremendous upset and concern. But the other was incredible anger that we had been performing while this was going on."
And it continues. Like, that's the thing I sort of missed when looking at this. Even once the band is on stage, the firsthand eyewitness quoted earlier says that this is happening. "I went back out to look for my friends after the show had started about 8:20, and I saw the same scene." So they just can't get everybody in fast enough. So they start the show before everybody's inside. "It was crazier between the outside doors and the turnstiles than it was outside. By then, people were really going for broke. I found my friend Bill, and he said," just try to imagine this, "he saw people going over the tops of doors, and he saw bodies piled in front of the door, and people were going over them and around them any way they could. At about 9, I saw more waves of people. I looked outside and saw what must have been thousands of dollars worth of personal articles strewn everywhere. Terrible piles of shoes. Shoes trapped in the chain link fencing between the turnstiles. I wonder about the kinds of injuries that weren't reported."
But here is what is reported. There's 11 dead, 26 injured, and the dead range between 15 years to 27 years old.
So this story leads to a very obvious question. Why weren't they opening the other doors?
The story is that management did not open more doors due to union restrictions and the concern of people gate crashing the ticket turnstiles.
Well, that happened. Union restrictions are a thing at arena shows. This is something normal concert goers have no idea about, and I don't know how much we want to go into this, but you and I have produced shows and we know a little bit about this. I remember producing an arena show at which the call was at 2, and here, this is how this works. So you contract with a certain amount of people for a certain amount of time, and if you go literally a second over, you pay them for the next block of time. So, like, you pay, if you're paying 5 hours, you're paying for the next 5 hours at 2:01 a.m., even if they're done at 2:02 a.m. And that, I mean, we had that happen, right? So it's like, that's why you're pushing to try to get things done or to not have more people or whatever, because it adds tremendous cost to the production. And so, yes, in retrospect, it seems like heartless. But in the moment, this is a financial decision where they're like, well, we can get everybody through that one set of doors. Obviously, this has not become a protocol going forward. People are you don't hear about there only being one entryway open for concerts after this much.
Here's something I don't think you and I have talked about, Brian. Before we met, I was involved with a theatrical production.
Oh, yeah.
And it was 6 weeks. So it's every night but Monday? So it's two performances on Saturday and Sunday. It was 8 performances a week. So after the first performance in this old theater in Kansas City, during the show, parts of the ceiling fall to the stage.
Oh, shit.
So
what venue was it?
It was the Music Hall in Kansas City.
Got it.
And that's when I found out about how that really works. because how do you fix that?
Yeah.
So
you got to call your people in.
So first, the show must go on. So the show kept going. So between, I guess, scenes or whatever, they kind of cleaned it up. But they had to make this like cocoon, like a mummy cocoon, to put up.
So pieces of the ceiling wouldn't fall?
Yeah. And I remember Wild. And I remember hearing about the overages and how much it costs to have everyone that was there working to do it. And like that was a losing money situation, which was basically used to rectify a dangerous situation, which had frickin' parts of the stage, like the ceiling were falling to the stage.
That's unbelievable.
But it was like an enormous amount of money because the amount of money that people were getting paid, the union hands were getting paid, was a lot. But I mean, you have to do it, right?
It's wild.
So what are the after effects of this from Cincinnati and this awful tragedy? We're going to talk both small stakes, immediate, and then the big industry changing stuff that we've already mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. So first, two other concerts going to be happening in December of that year that get canceled. Blue Oyster Cult and Aerosmith. That's the first thing that happens.
And so we already mentioned within days, the city outlaws festival seating in Cincinnati. And this causes venues and cities across the country to reassess how they handle ticketing. And
here's the wild seating. Thing. Trends come and go, and people's memories are relatively short. And so by the early 2000s, you remember how we said like this nearly decrepit venue now is keeping things from coming to Cincinnati?
Yeah.
This legislation by the early 2000s was keeping certain artists from coming to Cincinnati. And so there is this whole talk to, okay, can we go back and allow GA seating? I want to see if you can guess who is the first artist that they break the rule for in 2002. Think about who depends on GA seating.
Is it the Who?
Springsteen.
Oh, that makes sense.
And then they turn it over all the way in August of 2024.
The Who doesn't come back to Cincy until a couple years from now. Was it 2 years ago?
2022.
Yeah. So that's 2 years ago, and there's some great journalism in the show notes from Rolling Stone and others about their return to the city, and that's totally worth checking out. So check that out in the show
notes. And again, all of this original reporting, obviously this was very well documented, so there's a lot of vintage Rolling Stone and other stuff that goes really deep into this if you want to learn more. If you want to get involved in the show, it's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. You can find our studio feed on YouTube for a lot of these more recent episodes. Check us out there. You can support the show, patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. And until next time, Murdoch, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.